Renee was at the door, coming in from a night out at the discos with Bianca Jagger and Lauren Hutton. He was still high and smudged with their lipstick. He asked if I had passed out in my clothes again. No, it's a mystery. I was painting, and then, I don't know, you buzzed. Let's have a look, he said. We rounded the corner and looked at the painting on the easel. It was a shimmering jewel. Harry looked out at us with large, wet eyes. His lips, as if about to speak, both angel and devil. The background was vaporous. Renee burst out crying. It's so beautiful, he sobbed. This is the first painting of your career, the first to achieve the promise you held. Yeah, but I don't paint like that. I don't paint anywhere near that good. It doesn't have my telltale handiwork at all, I said, shocked. Well, then who did? Oh, I see what you're getting at. You mean, yes, it's not mine, it's his, I said, pointing at the opalescent image before us. Creepy, yet wonderful. Drug dealer to the avant-garde Norman Fisher died in California after an unsuccessful operation for skin cancer. Kramer's Easter duck, Little Lukey, died as well. My drug buddy from 1969, Dave Windsor, has a year to live with a malignant cancer. Death is lurking around, looking for business. Renee modeled for Alex Katz, and I modeled for Renee. Turns out he draws a bit like Degas. Most non-artists draw in a similar awkward way, not so Renee. He sat me down with a book on French Impressionism and said, "Let me explain art history to you." And he did. Deep pockets of knowledge about every reproduction in the book. He was particularly good on Basile, who died young. Another time, over at Crosby's old loft, he got out a copy of John Wiener's Hotel Wentley poems, read the whole thing aloud, cover to cover, weeping quietly as he did so. That was a good lesson in poetry, quite moving. I love to see the way others are struck by art, what kind of personal dialogue and response they may have with a painting or a poem. Of course, most people have none at all. But for some, it's top priority, extremely important. Aristocrats of aesthetics. July 2nd. Party at Bockwurst/Goldberg's for their new zine, Traveler's Digest. Meet Diego Cortez. I danced with ex-Catholic Terry Sellers, the redhead in Amos's movie. I bit her on the neck as part of my mating ritual. She liked it. I took her home with me and peeled off her fuzzy Angora sweater and capri pants. Beauty. Which led to hanging out with her all week. She lives at 101 St. Mark's Place under Ted Berrigan's apartment. She's pretty accepting about my wild ways, having grown up with alcoholic parents. She's not one to cast stones because she works as a dominatrix, catering to masochistic men at a Mahbone joint on East 53rd Street. No sex involved, verbal abuse being her specialty, but still, a dicey way to make a living. She's doing research for a book she's writing. So by night, she's a scary creature from Desaad. By day, she's a love-struck Bobby Soxer. She studied Latin and Greek at St. John's in Santa Fe. A scrambled egghead. I've never had an interest in S&M personally, which I explained to her. Not drawn to it in the slightest. She laughed and said it wasn't part of her needs. Don't worry about it. I'm just doing it for background for my book. So began our carnal adventures. I made her promise to never bring her work home with her, not with me. I admit I ain't no angel, but I do find it a bit unsavory. One downside was to do with Miles. He took one look at her, scowled, and went out the window to his rooftops, never to be seen again. What does he know that I don't? It was as if he said, "If she's staying, I'm going." July 10th. Terry and I venture to a little cabin she has access to on the Severn River near Annapolis, Maryland. We read, swim, she floats, she's a floater. Make love in the screen porch, draw, write, eat shrimp, listen to Tom Waits. I call her Pony Girl because of her ponytail. She resembles an inflatable dinosaur, or a goose. Also looks a bit like Stefan Audran, Chabrol's muse. A 5-day oasis of calm in an otherwise insane summer. I'm charmed by the little girl quality about her. I jotted down her observations on a walk in the woods. It's the ginkgos that make such furry shapes against the sky. Isn't that pretty? There's beans on that tree. There's flowers on that one. Look at that blade of grass growing out of that step. Look, little fruits. Pretty. These are my favorites. Smell. We hear the sound of panting. A dog walks by. Look at his face. Look at that fiendish dog. He's laughing. That fiendish mouth was made for yapping. He's a whitey. It's like being with a 9-year-old. She's given to the odd statement, such as, "Snakes know the future." July 18th. Meanwhile, back in the city, Son of Sam is still up to his .44 caliber tricks. I was meeting John Meany for a drink last night before the cinema at the high-toned Sign of the Dove at 65th and 3rd Avenue. Not my kind of place, expensive. But I was enjoying a vodka and tonic nonetheless, looking at my Timex periodically. There was a nice-smelling man next to me in a bespoke seersucker suit. I couldn't see his face, but admired his fancy platinum watch and the gold signet ring on his pinky. A dandy for sure. I hazarded a glance at his face. Oh my God, it's Lee Marvin. What? I took a slug of my drink. I snuck another peek. This time he was smiling at me with a look I've come to know. "Hello there," he said suggestively. Fuck! How could Lee Marvin, of all people, be a friend of Dorothy's? This shakes the very foundations of belief. I look closer. Not Lee Marvin at all, but someone who looks like his gay twin. Hi, I said, relieved that the world was restored to its former order. July 21st. Olive and her sister returned from Prague. Since I fell for Terry in her absence, she switches over to Kramer, who's got a loft a block away on 14th Street. There is much coming and going between the two residences. I had a tar beach party with Renee where we read Howl aloud, which was heightened by the rooftops around us and the Miles Davis floating out the windows. Very immediate, very romantic. August 10th. I switched exclusively to oil paints this summer. Oil paint is the big game to me. At first it seems like they're working against you, colors getting muddy quickly. But then, you find out how forgiving they can be. Everything can be changed. Plus, when you're done, there's that satisfying mineral surface, unlike the plastic glare of acrylic. I like the smell. I worked on a painting of Jean Gabin and Pepe Lamoco that was set up like one of Peter Blake's girl wrestler pictures, borders within borders. Working on canvases of Renee, Colin Wilson, and Wyndham Lewis as well. Started a larger canvas that is a take on the famous photo of Burroughs and Company in Tangier. I juxtapose me, Kramer, and Crosby into the gang, trying to enter the Beat Generation with my oil paints. I see a dapper art dealer around the scene, Julian Preto, who asks if he can come see my work. Of course. He does, and I get my ragtag group of canvases out, while he silently stares at each one. Finally, he says, "Is this what you do?" "Yeah." "But these are like real paintings." "I hope so," I say. "Isn't it hard to do?" "Yeah, very hard. I hardly know what I'm doing." I'm learning as I go along, trial and error. "Then why do it?" he says. "I just always wanted to be a painter." "Hmm. I just assumed you did something else." I could tell from his disappointed voice that he meant something cool, something more conceptual, something that required little effort, something that had quotes around it. If I was a young man about town, why would I devote myself to a dying medium? Didn't Art Forum proclaim that painting was dead? Why would a bright guy like me persist in an obsolescent practice? He left. August 14th. Drinking at the little table in the 55 with the acerbic poet Jim Gardner, I passed out, and he left. And when I came to, I'd had my wallet lifted. I'd finally been rolled. Whoever did it cashed a forged check for $20. Didn't even attempt to mimic my handwriting. But I lost my social security card, driver's license, etc. Serves me right to suffer. August 16th. Elvis Presley, a mort. Died in the crapper. An article in The Voice calls him the world's greatest solipsist, which was a new word to me. I know a lot of solipsists. Not a good way to be. Elvis had been an embarrassment for many, many years. The fat. The schmaltz. The superhero capes. Vegas. Nixon. August 21st. Terry takes me for my 25th birthday dinner at Café des Artistes, where Harry Crosby made his exit in a friend's studio, upstairs in 1929. Speaking of Harry, the portrait I did of him did not rest easily on my wall. It rattles. It quietly mutters. Its eyes seem to move. I assumed I was simply losing my mind due to the summer's excesses. I told no one. But then Kramer brought it up tentatively. He described the same paranormal activities that I had experienced. I corroborated his observations. Too creepy. The irony is, Harry was longing for the ultimate kick, death, which he assumed would deliver him to a phantasmagorical afterlife. But it appears he's still here, stuck in limbo, in a state of unrest. Poor sod. I hosted a birthday party for myself on a hot, sunny day, sent out a Xeroxed invite by Kramer, which portrayed me with a canine body, saying, "Doggone it, how did I ever get to be 25? The party attracted Ray Johnson, Diego Cortez, Anna Sui, Steven Meisel, various rockers, reprobates, miscreants, cigarette girls, denizens of the demi-monde, inverts, nut jobs, and groupies. One arrival told me to open my mouth as he entered and popped a pill in it. A quaalude, I think. Whatever it was, it left me down for the count in a half an hour. I was forced to retreat to my bedroom while the party roared outside my door. I missed all the fun. Behind the eight ball once again, Joey Ramone's cute girlfriend slipped in at one point, sat on the edge of the bed and suggested we meet alone some afternoon, somewhere private, so we could get to know each other better. She gave me her phone number written on a scrap of paper and an open-mouthed birthday kiss. If Terry found out, she'd kill me. Her worst fears confirmed. There is no wrath like that of an angry redhead. September 2nd. Unmade Beds plays the Deauville Film Festival. Amos, Patty, and Eric are there partying with Warhol and John Waters. Godard and Truffaut saw it. Godard liked it. How is that possible? I stayed in NYC because my lease is up in a month. The building is going condo, and they want $30,000 for my small loft. Out of the question. I'm looking for a new place with Terry. The Village has suddenly got expensive, but we did find an ad in The Voice that said, Artist Studio, $450 a month. So we went up to take a look. The old Hotel Alamax stands 20 stories tall at 160 West 71st Street, overlooking what was once called Needle Park, left over from the late 60s heroin epidemic. In fact, Jerry Schatzberg shot some of the panic in Needle Park in the building. There was a Wayland's Drugs downstairs where the junkies would congregate. The second floor corner apartment used to be the Swedish Institute of Massage, a legit enterprise to teach Swedish massage. The second floor is all offices, which means no nighttime neighbors. A large commercial space, many doors, no kitchen, but a subway-tiled bathroom. Big central room that could be my studio, high ceilings, across from the Beaux-Arts, Doralton. West and north exposures, looking up Broadway to the Ansonia, where Flo Ziegfeld and Babe Ruth lived. A second bedroom Terry can use as her office. A block from the IRT subway station. 2 blocks from the Hudson, and 3 blocks from Central Park. 2 blocks from John Lennon in the posh Dakota, where Polanski set Rosemary's Baby. Plus, it would get me away from all my beatnik friends, who drop in constantly with liquor, adding fuel to the fire. Those downtown snots won't schlep uptown. The way things are going, I'm not getting nearly enough work done living in the Village. And I won't improve without actually practicing my trade. Being cool ain't gonna cut it. They promised to install a stove and fridge. We signed the lease. Dad has offered to chip in $150 a month, which will pay a third of the rent. Later that night, about midnight, I was home working, and I get a call from Terry's place of work, the dungeon.
"Someone went nuts with a gun," Mistress Vivian said. "Terry's in the hospital. She's calling for you."
Panic. Imagining her dying of gunshot wounds. I rush up to New York Hospital and find her on a gurney, her forehead being sewn up with 10 stitches by a nice doctor. What happened was, she was sitting at the entrance to her torture chamber, and an Italian gangster came in for a stick-up. Wanted the cash box. She refused, and he pistol-whipped her. It could have been a lot worse. A pretty face isn't safe in this city. September 9th. Renee takes me up to the Dakota for Leonard Bernstein's daughter's birthday party. Never been in there before. LB has a sprawling, plush, second-floor apartment looking out in Central Park. The party is full of her snooty Yale friends. Amazing to be in this large sitting room, grand piano in the corner, on which she composed West Side Story, etc. The Ivy League kids are carrying on, blasting the Stones over and over. They don't care where they are. They're spoiled brats. At one point there's a lull, so I slip over and put Leonard's own copy of West Side Story on the hi-fi. It didn't last long. Some privileged motherfucker glared at me and said, "Are you trying to be funny?"
He took the LP off, noisily, and put the stones back on for the 10th time. Renee and I had a snoop around, looking at the celebrated man's interesting memorabilia. We even ventured into the master bedroom, where we were discovered being nosy by the returning Mrs. Bernstein. She was a bit alarmed, but Renee was instantly telling her about her Belgian lace collection.
How does he know about that?
She's very intrigued, getting on her knees to pull out drawers of the stuff. He elucidates her on each piece, goes on for quite a while. She takes his phone number with a promise to call. We left, deciding to take in the roof first.
How do you know so much about Belgian lace? I ask, as we look out over the panorama of nocturnal Central Park.
I know about a lot of stuff, he says enigmatically, lighting up an unfiltered Camel. His conversational jiu-jitsu keeps me on my toes. He is a wit atomizer. You'd never know there's so much trouble in this city, judging from the pastoral view before us, I said.
Olmsted's dream, says Renee.
Renee tells me about Fairfield Porter, the 1950s impressionist who went against the grain, transcribing the dailiness that lay before his eyes, a painterly response to poetry. Fairfield was in love with the poet Jimmy Schuyler, though married with children. I've been painting ghosts, an ARP-like shape hovering inside or outside a location of my choosing, like Harry Crosby's bathroom, Monty Cliff's townhouse, Shakespeare and Company. Also been painting the new apartment. Painted the living room Gauloise blue, the bedroom a dark grayish brown with gold trim that should help with hangovers. Terry painted her office a dark symbolist green. She loves Gabrielle D'Annunzio. Writes in purple prose herself. She says, don't talk with your mouth open. October 2nd. Wim Wenders, The American Friend. Love the scene where Bruno Gans listens to the entire Too Much on My Mind by the Kinks in his workshop. October 5th. Terry's 25th birthday. Saw a matinee of Pasolini's Salo at the Cinema Village. I was periodically disgusted, but Terry was turned on by the images of submission and brutality and spontaneously gave me a blowjob in the mostly empty theater. Kneeling in front of me in her Charles Jourdain boots on the sticky cinema floor. October 6th. The return of Iggy. Audience filled with phony Bolsheviks trying to look mean, but instead just looking grouchy. Iggy turned on some hecklers tonight, saying, thanks, creeps. You were never that smart anyway. Do you know you're gonna die? How can you stand your face in the mirror? Thanks, fuckheads. Can you feel it? Can you feel that I'm better than you? October 23rd. Bill Evans at the Village Vanguard. He's bearded, bloated, hunched over his piano, playing his sad songs. I heard he lives a block from me with writer Gene Lees on 71st and West End Avenue. On a related note, the other day I was standing in line at the local branch of my Chase Manhattan Bank. There was a drifter in front of me, dressed in a dirty double-knit denim leisure suit. I looked down at his feet, which were exposed in a pair of crappy sandals. Gross toes. Who is this junked-out desperado? He turned and scowled at me with his deeply lined face and sunken cheeks. It was Chet Baker, he of the angelic sounds. Sometimes bad people do good things. New films. The American Friend. Salo.
Mr. Klein. Julia. 1900. Saturday Night Fever. Cry of the City. The Big Combo.
You're a beautiful woman, Rita, but you're stupid.
Thieves Like Us. They Live by Night. Kiss of Death. November 15th. Baltus at the Pierre Matisse Gallery. He's a no-show. Does he not enjoy New York?
I love his combination of Courbet and French psychosexual melodrama.
December 17th. Ray Johnson party. He looks like Sluggo. When I try to tell him a funny story, he just says, mm-hmm. But then I'll get a missive in the mail with some detail of my story that was completely beside the point. But that's what he focuses on. He's a lot like a cat. It's on his kooky terms. February 23rd, 1978. Victor Bakris presents a one-night-only show of my paintings at his apartment. Alan Lewis Kleinberg took moody photos of the proceedings. Alan used to do hair for Avedon. Victor said John Lennon was coming. He didn't. Victor Hugo did and offered to trade one of my paintings for a cum-stained sheet by him. But you have to make me hard, he added. No thanks. The things I have to put up with. I showed 1. Twin gynecologists. 2. Harry Crosby. 3. Montgomery Clift. 4. Francoise Sagan. Sold. 5. James Dean. 6. Lawrence Harvey. 7. Burroughs in NYC. 8. Alain Delon. 9. The Strand. Self-portrait. 10. Colin Wilson. 11. René Clair. Domestic melodramas. Terry and I are as bad as each other. I with my drinking, she with her delusional psychosis. We inflict mutual mental tortures on each other, loosely laid out like a semblance of love in El Madhouse. One night, I was in an alcoholically induced state of paranoia. I was convinced there were Nazis in the other room looking for us. I made her lie on her back on the bedroom floor and began to cover her with books because they would protect her. I was whispering, lest the Nazis hear me. The Nazis are usually burbling around in my subconscious. I hate Nazis. She also has a side to her that is definitely crazy, jealous, brittle, schizo. We go together like guns and ammunition. Hope we snap out of this downward spiral. Will we look back on our present sufferings with a smile? For all our disharmony, our sex life remains healthy. We sometimes wake up in our sleep to find we are fucking. That's a first for me. February 26. The Foreigner opens at the Millennium. Jay Hoberman writes, Max Menace, the anti-hero of Amos Poe's sodden attempt at a blank generation, Alphaville, arrives in New York, moves into the Chelsea and watches the Sex Pistols on TV, and waits for instructions, which never quite come together. Neither does the film. A dead ringer for Dobie Gillis, Max, Eric Mitchell, is terrorized by assorted thugs, shadowed by a female private eye, captured by a Lower East Side dominatrix, beaten up in the toilet of CBGB, chased down the Bowery, and at long last crucified in Battery Park. Punk deserves better. April 30th. The Foreigner plays at the Whitney as part of the New American Filmmaker series. The Times' Tom Buckley gave it a very bad review.
No one in the cast, which includes a couple of comely young women, has the least idea of how to act. The story is infantile, and the photography, sound, and editing are primitive in a way that stopped being amusing 10 years ago. He called it the cinematic equivalent of kindergarten scribbles. Amos used this last quote on the poster. He embraces his liabilities. June 8 to 12. Little off-season vacation in East Hampton, staying at the Hunting Inn on Main Street. Took the train out, rented 2 3-speed bikes from the hardware store. We pedal by the potato fields, Georgica Pond, the Maidstone Club, the graves of Sarah and Gerald Murphy. Fresh air and sodomy by the sea. Terry eats garlicky frog legs. She likes dipping into the old terrarium. She says, I could eat frogs forever. There's a very good used paperback store that is chock full of treasure. Nothing I love more than inspecting a row of pocketbooks. Mysteries inside. I always have a look at the bookcase in a strange apartment. Know the books, know the man. I'm reading Faulkner's The Wild Palms, which is terrific. New records. Symphony of the Winds, Stravinsky. Piano Works, Eric Satie. Trois Chansons, Maurice Ravel. Music for 18 Musicians, Steve Reich. Sarah Vaughan and Hi-Fi. One sifts through the endless cultural offerings. It's a bombardment of sensation. That's what Manhattan is all about. One must be discriminating. I'm tired of the irony of pop art. Irony's overrated. Tired of the ambivalence so in vogue. I'm not swayed by the flavor du jour. Give me Jules Pascin any day. Or the 2 dozen self-portraits by Sheila over at Sabarsky. I was shopping in the Pioneer Supermarket on Columbus Avenue, picking up some apples and raisin bran. Who do I spot but Dashiell Hammett's old girlfriend, Lillian Hellman, looking like she just smoked a trillion cigarettes? He left her briefly for ingenue Patricia Neal, and they made mad, passionate love at 20 West 10th Street. I'd have done it, too. Europe. Time to go back to Europe. Been 6 years for me. The Foreigner's been accepted at the Deauville Film Festival, and Amos assures us that we'll be put up royally. We sublet the apartment to a Eurotrash Italian named Paolo and left. September 2nd. New York to London. Ridiculous punk clones on the King's Road. Spitting. Giving everyone the finger. Give me a break, you cookie-cutter morons. Took the ferry from Dover to Rouen, Pernod in hand, standing on deck with a sense of history, squinting into the sea air. Spent the night, then got in a train for Deauville, where we found Amos ensconced in the Normandy Hotel. He answered the door in his robe and said, Duncan, Terry, what are you doing here? Not a good start. We walked to the casino, which is the festival headquarters. JFK's pal, Pierre Salinger, is kicking off the proceedings in the main theater. He's making a speech to welcome us to the 4th annual festival and inviting notables on stage, such as King Vidor, Gloria Swanson, Robert Stack, Elliot Ness, Kirk Douglas, Van Gogh! And then, Duncan Hanna. What? I'm hungover and jet-lagged, but pull myself together and trundle on stage in my blue jeans and black leather jacket, going through the gauntlet of these luminaries, shaking hands. How you doing, King? I muttered to the ancient director. Amos and Terrier called out, too. So we're all standing up there facing the press, the film industry, the fans. We're imposters. Just some lowlife from downtown Gotham. Surreal. Thus began a week of screenings, parties, and just lolling about in the main lounge of the casino, quaffing down the free champagne contributed by Mums. 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. every day. Trouble. Let's stay high on champagne the whole time, says Terry. She speaks French, so translates for me. Trouble is, she translates English for me, too. Headstrong Irish girl that she is. We were put up in the Très Élégant Normandy Hotel, completely free of charge. We watched our morning lovemaking in the big mirrored wardrobe, our room service breakfast litter on the polished desk. We had fun dressing up every day for the deluxe events, tidy receptions, pretty garden parties, etc. Everyone has chic clothes, lots of style, lots of cash. Photographer Marsha Resnick showed up in our room, direct from Paul Bowles' joint in Tangier. She's got pictures to prove it. She's crashing the festival. Savvy Marsha. We met some Parisian film kids named Remy and Berndt. Berndt, who always wears an ascot, gave me a bottle of Guerlain's Vetiver because I had commented on how nice he smelled. Sweet. They wanted to hear first-hand reports from the NYC front line about the Ramones, Blondie, Dolls, etc. I wanted to hear about Delon. They said he was a right-wing pig and a murderer. Just another mainstream asshole. You like him? Dapper Remy asked, disappointed. Well, isn't it interesting that a guy who often plays killers is, perhaps, a murderer? I ventured. It's like being a fan of Robert Redford, mainstream, they explained. He's just part of the ubiquitous French scenery. Tell us about Johnny Thunders, they said. Johnny Thunders? He's just a moronic junkie, I countered. I guess the grass is always greener. We lamented the death of Keith Moon just 3 days ago. O.D. Down and out in Deauville. Milling around the lobby waiting for screenings and press interviews were Susan Sarandon, Robe Grier, George Papard, Leslie Caron, John Waters, who told us dirty jokes, and the mayor of Deauville. The press says our film, The Foreigner, captures exactly the sense of rootlessness, moral ambiguity, and alienation which makes up a major part of the atmosphere of America's major cities. Highfalutin. One day, Amos, Terry, and I had lunch with King Vidor, who's really a queen, not a king, and Gloria Swanson outdoors on the boardwalk. I told her I'd seen her at Candy Darling's funeral. I don't know who that is, she said sharply. She was very like Norma Desmond, a creature from another time. Amos asked King questions about filming in the silent era. 1 year he shot 14 films. After lunch, I walked the beach with Berndt, who drew a Tyrannosaurus Rex in the sand. He told me of a suicide attempt and how sometimes it's so hard to live. I was reflecting on how I'd been to Deauville with my parents 12 years ago. We'd been to Normandy Beach, wandering through the endless field of white crosses from all the American boys who had died on D-Day. They found it hard to live, too. They was robbed. Gypped. The rumor going round was that John Travolta was holed up in Trouville with his friend. We wanted him to stop being such a star and come down and play with us. Funny John Waters in particular wanted his company. Finally, the big night of the Grease premiere came, and Travolta and Olivia Newton-John arrived, looking stellar. Terry and I sat behind them in the cinema, and we watched the movie together. It was great, I have to say. At the end, There was a standing ovation, and John turned around and flashed his 1,000-watt smile on the rapturous audience. Star power! The spotlights reflected off his gleaming white teeth and beamed around the 19th-century theater. Terry and I weren't invited to the closing night's party, but watched the guests file in on the Grand Palais' muffled floral carpet as the flashbulbs popped. François Sagan herself walked along the regal hall, past the chandeliers and gilded mirrors. She was laughing. She'd probably been here a lot, this being the kind of place favored in her books, where the idle rich come to gamble and misbehave. September 13th to 27th, Venice. We got a night train from Paris to Venice, filled with American fashion models going to Milan for the collections. Bottles of red wine were produced from bags passed around. I envied their gypsy lives. Casa Frollo on Giudecca is our new home for 2 weeks after the nonstop party that was Deauville. Large bedroom, breakfast in the piazza. I'm reading Roderick Hudson by Henry James, plus Harry Crosby's diaries, Shadows of the Sun, which are very funny. He's like a naughty kid. I crouch in the stone floor and make collages with the scraps I've picked up during our trip and glue from the stationers. European packaging has much better color than the USA's. The collages instantly look more classical, more European. Listening to the new silver transistor radio, which pulls in the distant Radio Luxembourg, is that Kraftwerk? Or just static? Hard to tell. Wearing my new V-neck sweater, playing with the two elegant Italian switchblades I bought. Such beautiful objects. Not writing so much anymore, because I'm reading more, too drunk, living with a writer. Terry is writing all the time. We take the Vaporetto to the mainland. They're filming A Little Romance with Laurence Olivier and Diane Lane in San Marco Square. Sit and watch the action with Eretzina and the Pigeons. Have another cocktail at the Greedy Palace. Another at Crowded Harry's Bar. We wander into the night, get lost in the watery maze, wind up where we started off. It's like a dream. Dinner at Trattoria I Cugnai. Standing in an illuminated courtyard with long, sinister shadows, like a Baltus stage set. Baltus must be here, too. He's the featured artist at the Venice Biennale. Walking over an arched footbridge, I see a dead cat in the canal. My stomach is full of rough grappa. We missed the last launch to Giudecca, so we get a water taxi. A low-slung chris-craft of polished wood and leather. I'm flopped in the back as we surge into action. The Rialto recedes from view, the mossy pilings punctuating the black water. Colors that would swallow up all colors. I hear the liquid music of the Venetian night. I must paint this sensation, to be drunk in this runabout. The blurred lights of Venice merging with the rooster tail of churned-up froth. This is intoxication at its finest, euphoria. We venture to the long, skinny Lido, walking towards the beach through the shaded Gran Viale, with its striped tents, full Italian ices, soccer balls and nets, straw hats. Death in Venice fluttering through my mind, Tazio, the Excelsior Hotel, uniformed bellboys. The season is over. It's deserted. I strip down to my boxers and step into the icy Adriatic and swim out as far as I can, because Harry Crosby did a long time ago. Dead Man's Challenge. My heart is stunned by the freezing temperature. Is this it? No. I live to face another day. Peggy Guggenheim's small museum. She herself is sitting in the garden at the exit. She's been around the block a few times. Starts asking me questions with a slightly flirtatious manner. September 27th, drunk in Paris. Staying on Boulevard Raspail at the Hotel de la Paix. Room for two, about $18. I pee in the sink. Modigliani's studio is in this old building. The dome, just at the corner for my morning café crème and croissant. Mansard roofs everywhere. We drink at the legendary local joints, La Coupole, the Jockey, Closerie de Lila, and the Rotonde, where gypsies make a spectacle of goats climbing a stepladder and climbing back down. We visit Père Lachaise Cemetery, where Amadeo Modigliani, 1884 to 1920, and Jean Hibertin, 1898 to 1920, are laid to rest. She defenestrated at age 22, unable to live without her Modi. Bit of hard cheese on their daughter. The black marble slab plastered with wet yellow and orange autumn leaves. Reverie for the dear departed. Pungent smell of chestnuts. One night, I meet Amos and his French girlfriend, Lily, for a few drinks in Montparnasse. Terry was back in the room with bronchitis. Upon leaving them, I promptly got lost. I was happy to wander the empty cobbled streets in the mist. Found myself by the outside wall of a cemetery. A figure fell in beside me. I could see his breath out of the corner of my eye. Hear his breathing. It was Modigliani. Black corduroy suit, maroon scarf, broad-brimmed hat, workman's boots. Ghastly pallor, as if he was made out of tallow. Vaguely phosphorescent. What could one say? I was both honored and frightened. He's been dead for almost 60 years. It struck me that this poor guy never moved on. Why is he still here? He should be in some kind of paradise. We were walking abreast of one another. I finally said, "It's you." "Yes, you summoned me," or something to that effect. Did we speak English, French? I don't know. Was it telepathic? "Are you here?" I asked sympathetically. "I hope not." "I'm everywhere," he said. "That's good," I thought. "Everywhere is good." We walked on. I could hear our footsteps in tandem. Clop, clop, clop. He turned his drawn face slightly towards mine, his moist black eyes glittering like marbles in the gloom. "You carry on," he advised. And with that, he forked off and disappeared in the mist. Poof! Good exit. I was profoundly moved by this paranormal visitation. I stopped and breathed in deeply. It makes sense in a way. My psychic extremities being conducive to the afterworld switchboard. When I finally found my hotel, Terry was in one of her jealous rages, demanding to know who I'd been with. "Just Amos and Lily," I repeated. She said no, I'd been with someone else, and she knew it. "Who? Who? Who?" I relented and said, "Okay, I have been with someone." "Who?" "Modigliani." She screamed that I was a liar and pitched an ashtray at my head, which narrowly missed my eye. So much for my encounter with the shadow world. Modi didn't prove to be much of an alibi. One night, a gay guy we met in Venice, Patrick, had a dinner party for me and Terry in Paris. He thought we were like Scott and Zelda. Gays love Terry, because she's a bit like a drag queen herself. They appreciate her bitchiness. Me, not so much. He warned me not to overindulge, because he was going to invite some Parisian intelligentsia that could benefit my career. I showed up very drunk and was seated next to international art dealer Ileana Sonnabend, an old crone who I found to be extremely pompous and condescending. And eventually, I told her so. I do not suffer arrogant fools gladly when I've had as many beverages as I'd had that day. She was going on about the spirituality of Kupka, a painter I've always found rather tepid. And I asked her, how would she know, since she was devoid of a soul? My host turned green. Time to go. I lurched out. In the morning, Patrick called our hotel room. I began to apologize, and he stopped me. No, 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 it's fine. You were a huge hit. They couldn't stop talking about the young Ange Maudit from New York. I was shocked. But I behaved abominably. Why did they respond like that? Because Charles Bukowski was here last month, and he was so rude that everyone decided he was a genius. Now you come along with more of the same. They loved it. Ha! Saved by Bukowski. They think boorishness is the latest movement from the USA. Maybe it always was. One day Terry and I were hanging out by the Pompidou Center, having just seen a Tamara de Lempicka show that was pretty cool. And who should we run into but old pal Joseph Astor, who has relocated to Paris to do some male modeling. He was with Brian Geisen. We go off for a drink, and Joseph fills me in on news from NYC. Apparently, there was a roof party in Tribeca with the old Minneapolis gang. Kramer was drunkenly dancing on the rooftop's edge in oversized cowboy boots, playing the daredevil for some girls, his old party trick. They turned away so as not to encourage him. When they turned back, he was gone. They looked over the edge. He'd not gone down the 12 flights, but only 1.5, landing on his face. A pool of blood was spreading. McDermott and Peter Nolan Smith climbed down a ladder to see if he was alive. He was, but he'd broken most of the things you could break. They got him into an ambulance with great difficulty. Consequently, he was pieced back together from photographs. His head was the size of a jack-o'-lantern. Lots of traction, bolts, wired jaws, etc. Horrifying. The writing is on the wall. This is my second friend to go off a roof. The rest of Paris was a blur of the Louvre, Love David's self-portrait, Eiffel Tower, Pigalle, Harry Crosby's apartment at 19 Rue de Lille, the Ritz Bar, the Pont Royal Bar, Cour de Rohan, Balthus, Beat Hotel, 9 Rue Gilles Le Cour, La Pain Agile, Boat Pond in Luxembourg Gardens, Le Palace Discotheque, etc. Real French poodles. Adrift in New York. October 12th, London to New York, 1978. In the cab on the way home from JFK, the radio newsman says Sid Vicious is in jail, being held for the murder of Nancy Spungen in the Chelsea Hotel last night. Welcome home. I remember my one run-in with her. I was going to visit Christian and Lance. She lived in their building, a stripper and a junkie. We got in the elevator together in the lobby. As the doors closed, she asked if I was going to visit those guys. Yes. She asked if I had any drugs. No. She said I was cute and offered me a blowjob. Not today, thanks, I said. I didn't even know who she was. When I got to Lance's apartment, I told him about my ride with his skanky, peroxided neighbor. Ha ha ha! You've just met Nancy Spungen. It's not the first time she's propositioned one of our visitors. She's a pest. He thought this all very funny. The trick is to live as if you're going to die and then not die. Didn't work out that way for Nancy. Our Italian subletters had trashed our apartment, plus run up a $515 long-distance phone bill. Ugh. At least Cuckoo the Cat is okay. Books. Piracy, Michael Arlen. The Razor's Edge, Somerset Maugham. Those Who Walk Away, Patricia Highsmith. The Human Factor, Graham Greene. The Honorary Consul, Graham Greene. Humboldt's Gift, Saul Bellow. Vanity of Deleuze, Jack Kerouac. Delta of Venus, Anais Nin. Exiles, Michael J. Arlen. The Flying Dutchman, Michael Arlen. Truffaut Hitchcock. The Sheltering Sky, Paul Bowles. Without Stopping, Paul Bowles. Tristessa, Jack Kerouac. Exiles Return, Malcolm Cowley. My Name is Archer, Ross MacDonald. The Tremor of Forgery, Patricia Highsmith. The Paris Diary and the New York Diary, Ned Roram. The Green Man, Kingsley Amis. The Brothel at 211 East 53rd Street. I stop at Terry's on my way home from a night of drinking downtown. She's with a client, so I sit in the waiting room of the Straight Whorehouse down the hall, run by the same mobsters who operate the torture chamber. 8 women per shift. No decor to speak of. We might as well be in a doctor's office. The girls are friendly enough, offer me a drink. Not particularly attractive. Gaudy get-ups. They're talking about who cocked their pussies last. They get $50 an hour. They yawn. They smoke. Terry comes in with a whopping wad of cash from tonight's slaves. She doesn't have sex with her Johns. Far from it. She messes with their sick psyches. I don't know how she can do it. She's not exactly a testament to sanity herself. I fear this will push her over the edge. It has to take its toll on her. How could it not? What about karma? But you know what they say about people who live in glass houses. I'm not exactly a saint myself. I'm fucked up. We get a cab home. Terry reads her tarot cards. She is studying the occult. White magic, she says. What if she gets black by accident? Summon a demon by mistake. In my dreams, I write books. Literally. Then I read them. They're not bad. I was reading one in my dream and marveling at the beautiful prose when Doc Bray appeared at my apartment door. I let him in and told him I'd just been reading something so lyrical. How amazing it was, the brain, to be able to write, then read, all in a dream. I can still see it, and closed my eyes and read aloud the afterimage of the text. When I finished, I said, "Pretty good, huh?" Yeah, and it always was, too. That's the last paragraph of Moby Dick, you dope. But I've never read Moby Dick. How could it get into my brain? He didn't believe me. But I checked in a bookstore later, and sure enough, those were the words I saw. Where did they come from? Who else is using my brain? Doc Bray called Crosby a foolish dirt mound. That's an insult I've never heard. One day, he and I were mooching around Brooks Brothers, and I looked at the person across from me, sorting through men's pajamas. Brown watch cap, brown overcoat, slacks, brogues. A woman. I recognized something in the eyes and mouth. Garbo. I played it cool, and somehow we all drifted into the elevator. Doc Bray, too. That most private of all retired film stars bowed her head.